House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's approximately 3:20 on March 19th. With us today, members present are Representative Heron, Representative Reinbold, Representative Josephson, Representative Millette, Representative Sadler, and myself, Chair Olson. We have Speaker Chenault in transit, who will be here shortly. We have three bills on the calendar today. The first up will be HCR 15, Task Force on Unmanned Aircraft Systems. Sponsor is with us, and with that, Representative Hughes and Ginger, do you want to come to the table, one or both, or? And thank you for joining us today. And briefly, we took public testimony on this bill on February 21st. We held the bill over, and the public comments are still open, but it is my intent to see if we can get through it today. Anyway, can you give us a brief summary of the bill, since it's already been heard once? I think most of us in the room have heard it, but just briefly, can you give us a summary of the bill, and then we'll get on to the amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I might start by saying the point of the bill.
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, yes,
record,
yes.
Please.
I forgot about that. I can't believe that. I'm Shelley Hughes, representative from Greater Palmer District 8. And the point of this bill is to allow the Task Force on Unmanned Aircraft to continue. We were formed last year, and we primarily address privacy and law enforcement use, and that was through another piece of legislation, as you all are aware. But this is an emerging technology, and we expect other issues to surface. And we have taken the approach, the task force took the approach, rather than being extremely prohibitive, which would discourage industry, we want to take care of problems and fix them if they arise. And so in order to do that, as this is a growing industry, we would need the task force to continue. So, Mr. Chair, that is essentially to allow the task force to continue. It does change the membership a bit, and I could go over that if you'd like. I'm not sure how much detail you want.
I think the committee has had the bill and heard it before, but that was more for the people in the room that might have. Any questions for the sponsor? With that, we have two draft proposed amendments. Amendment /U1 will not be offered today. Well, actually, won't be offered at all. And can I have a motion to adopt Amendment U.2?
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment 28-LS1190/U.2. Amendment?
And I'll object for discussion. And Conrad Jackson from my office can explain it. And thanks again, Representative Hughes and Ginger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. The amendment before the committee, U.2, was developed in conjunction with some discussions with the sponsor and some other members. And the idea is to make the unmanned aircraft task force a little more, since it kind of fits with the committee, a little more commerce friendly. The amendment would add the Commissioner of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, or the Commissioner's designee, along with two additional public members. The idea there being a little more public participation. And the biggest part of those two public members is on the amendment, lines 18 and 19. And we're trying to get public members who have experience with unmanned aircraft, actual piloting of the unmanned aircraft. And then you'll see down on page or line 22 and 23, we are attempting to encourage the task force, or tasking the task force with developing the unmanned aircraft system industry in the state of Alaska.
Any questions for Conrad on U.2? With that, I'll look my objection. Are there any further objections? Seeing none, U.2 passes. And I will reopen public testimony, and we have Jane Dale from the Alaska Airkers online. Ms. Dale, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for joining us today, and please state your name and affiliation for the record, and we appreciate you calling in.
That's great. My name is Jane Dale, and I'm with the Alaska Air Carriers Association Legislative Affairs. And I just have a brief testimony. The Alaska Air Carriers Association has supported the work that the task force has done to clarify privacy issues and further the integration of UAS into the system. As UAS rapidly become part of our aviation culture and likely play a role to further commerce in Alaska, we support the extension of the task force to 2017. To assist with that. The carriers also support the addition of a seat for the Alaska Air Carrier membership on the task force, as our membership is encountering UAS in our national airspace now. The Department of Interior recently received FAA approvals for unmanned air systems use that streamlines past procedures for operation. UAF is operating UAS under the auspices of research, and this past year the first commercial endeavor was launched. These successes come with concerns, conflicts, and potential issues with traditional air carrier operations. And the air carriers would appreciate participating in the task force to research and recommend resolution to issues. I just want to say thank you very much for allowing us to testify, and if someone has a question, I'd be happy to answer it.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you again for joining us today. Is there anybody else online? None. And we do have Michaela Fowler from Commerce here for questions only, if we have any Commerce-related questions. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee for discussion. Is there any committee discussion? Representative Aaron.
Is by the end of the task force, is there going to be at least one legislator that knows how to operate one of these vehicles?
I hope there's at least two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no further questions, what are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move to report HCR-15 as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any opposition to moving the bill out of committee? Seeing none, HCR 15 will move on to the its next stop. And with that, we'll take a brief adieu. Next item on the bill is House Bill 370. Would you join us, Anna, please? Anna Latham is on my staff, and this is a labor and commerce bill. For everybody's attention, the packet for this bill was not sent out on time. We were about 10 minutes late, so for that reason we will be hearing it today, but we will be holding it over for further discussion. I just wanted to let everybody know that I apply the same rules to myself, and it seems to be working much better. We learned. I learned. Welcome back, Anna.
Thank you.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
For the record, my name is Anna Latham, staff to Representative Olson. And before you today is House Bill 370, an act relating to employer drug testing requiring the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board to adopt regulations relating to the prescription of controlled substances to employees and limiting the prescription of controlled substances to employees. So I'd briefly like to go over the sectional. Section 1 authorizes employers to drug test injured workers for controlled substances listed in Schedule 1A under AS 1171-140 if the employee has been prescribed a controlled substance for over 90 days as a result of a workplace injury. Section 2 requires the Workers' Compensation Board to adopt regulations pertaining to the prescription of controlled substances to implement Section 3. And Section 3 limits a physician's prescription of controlled substances listed in Schedule 1A under AS 1171-140, or a controlled opium substance listed in Schedule 3A under AS 1171-160, or 5A under AS 1171-180. The intent of House Bill 370 is to discourage the use of long-term opioids by restricting prescriptions to a 30-day supply. And also, it allows employers to drug test employees that have been prescribed a Schedule 1A controlled substance for more than 90 days, primarily to see if the employee is diverting this prescription. Statistics show that 1 in 4 prescriptions is used by someone that has not been prescribed the medication. And this is medication that an employer is paying for either directly if they're self-insured or through insurance premiums. The drugs that are referred to in this legislation are opioids, which are synthetic versions of opium-derived drugs. Under Title 11, controlled substances are classified into 6 categories, with Schedule 1A having the highest degree of danger to a person or the public, and Schedule 6 having the lowest degree of danger or probable danger to the public. For example, morphine is classified as a Schedule 1A drug, marijuana is classified as a Schedule 6 drug. And the Schedule 3A and 5A drugs in the bill referred in Section 3 are opiate derivatives that vary in strength. So they are, an example would be codeine, with Schedule 3A being a stronger prescription than the Schedule 5A. And use of higher dosages of opioids over long periods of time can lead to addiction, increased disability, work loss, and even death. And I'm sure you've seen the statistics in the packet that I provided, and those handouts had a lot of the implications of opioid prescriptions on workers' comp claims. Last year, just to give you an example, there were approximately 200 deaths due to opioid abuse as a result of workers' comp claims. So not only is prescription drug abuse a public health and safety issue, prescriptions are also a cost driver for workers' comp premiums. And as you've heard my testimony on House Bills 141 and House Bill 316 in this committee, you're well aware of the problems that Alaska is facing, having the highest workers' comp premiums in the nation. In 2011, prescription drugs compromised almost 20% of medical costs in workers' comp claims in Alaska. Workers that missed a week or more of work in over 90% of the time had prescriptions covered by workers' comp. And out of that 90%, anywhere from 60 to 80% received opioids for their prescriptions. And there's been an incentive at the state level to address the overuse and misuse of opioids, and many states are implementing reforms at this time. They've gone about that in a variety of ways, either restricting physician dispensing, implementing pain management guidelines, restricting the dosages and lengths of time that opiates can be prescribed, and there's also been an increase in the use of random drug testing in workers' comp claimants with the use of long-term narcotics. I'd like to share some statistics with you that were included in your packet, and this is from the Lockton report, just because I find them quite alarming. 71% of workers' compensation claimants on chronic opioid therapy greater than 3 months are not taking their pain medication as prescribed due to misuse or abuse. 38% of patients were found to have no detectable level of prescription medication in their system. 29% had non-prescribed medication. 27% had drug levels that were higher than expected. And 11% had illicit drugs in their system. And these statistics were, I believe, from 2011, and they were based on a sample of 939,000. So that's a fairly large pool for this. And they really reiterate the need for limiting opioid prescriptions and allowing employer drug testing and workers' comp claims. So that concludes my testimony for House Bill 370, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Josephson.
Mr. Chairman, just as at the outset, I'm trying to figure out procedurally how you want to do this, because I'd have about 15 minutes of conversation, and I'll do some, and then we'll see what the mood is.
Do you want to hold off for a few minutes?
Sure.
Perfect. I might be answering some of them in the next couple of minutes, but I'd like to add that we're currently doing another bill that would address the issue of physician dispensing of opioids. And we have been looking at for over a year a bill for next year that would address the best practices for pain management that will all tie in with this. Plus, we have a fee structuring bill that's also currently before the legislature, and they're all told there are a number of bills that all tie together. But this particular bill was not an original thought. It's being done in a number of other jurisdictions around the country, and it is having a significant impact on rates from the standpoint that if somebody is not taking their medication and it shows up, obviously they're not in pain and that they may have found a new job. It's had a, and we're not stepping between the doctor and his patient. We're saying that the doctor should see the patient more often before he gives automatic refills on things like OxyContin. And with that, Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Millett. I'd like to acknowledge, I think I acknowledge Representative Chenault, who came in a couple minutes right after we gaveled in. And Representative Thompson is here for...
okay.
Probably the next bill? No. Yes.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I'll just give sort of a sampling since we're going to be... Ms. Latham, is there any sense at all that the bill's intent is to act as an arm of government? That is, is the goal to look for some kind of criminal misconduct?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, there's not any intent to look for criminal misconduct.
Okay.
There is just the main intent of this bill is to lower costs for workers' comp premiums.
Okay.
So restricting insurers for paying for opioid prescriptions that patients are not taking is one way to cut those costs.
Follow-up. Your introduction suggested both a concern with the abuse of, that is, too many pills being swallowed, and too few. What do you see as the stronger objective or the goal?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I am particularly concerned with prescriptions that are not being taken. The reason that I touched on the widespread abuse is just because it's probably a familiar topic for everyone in the room, is prescription abuse, drug abuse being a widespread problem throughout the nation and considered a national epidemic. So that would be something that would render some familiarity for members. But the intent of the legislation is to monitor those that are taking opioids, so that if they're not taking the prescriptions that insurers are paying for under a workers' comp claim, the insurance companies, the employers, will not pay for them.
But again, Representative Josephson, if they're UAs are used in a number of occupations and for different reasons, but if they're clean and they're still collecting prescriptions automatically, again, they're obviously ready to go back to work or they have a new profession.
Right.
And a number of the drugs are being diverted to somebody that is not the patient.
Ms. Latham, may I?
Certainly.
The law, the case law on this, there have been four major U.S. Supreme Court cases and at least one major Alaska Supreme Court case. These are considered searches and seizures. A search under the Fourth Amendment. Now, that doesn't mean they can't sometimes be done, but there's something called a special needs test. Has anyone vetted with Ledge Legal whether the special needs test is met?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, there has not been any advice back from Ledge Legal on this particular bill, as far as, or from Department of Law. But this, the statute that it falls under is under employee policies, so that really would just allow the employer policies to recognize that this will be part of a condition of employment.
What if I may?
Yeah.
What if the fact was that the patient / workers' comp claimant simply didn't want to develop a habit with an opioid, and so he or she made a decision not to take a medication? Can we infer from that he or she must be dealing the drugs?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
And if this is restricted to a 30-day supply, mm-hmm. and they choose not to take the drugs, then there wouldn't be any reason for that employee to have to contact their physician and have any more than a 30-day supply.
And again, the doctor can renew it forever if the patient is showing signs that he needs it, maybe not forever, but for as long as he needs to. But it's just requiring that there is oversight, and it's not 3 months' worth of drugs. And by the way, how many states are doing something similar? Not that we care what other states are doing, but
15 states have something similar.
It has been tested around the country.
Sure.
Court tested.
Of course, the APD decision from 2001 emphasizes the privacy clause. What is the... do you have any concerns that this would result in more workers' comp litigation because employers and their insurance companies will say, you're not truly injured, you couldn't be because you're not taking your meds, your pain must not be that great, therefore you're healed? I mean, is there any concern that we're creating other sorts of problems?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I don't believe this is going to cause increased litigation. Mm-hmm. Most likely it'll just stop extra prescriptions from being written and not being taken.
And Representative Josephson, I'm going to roll on to a couple of other members, but I'd like to add that we do have people in the room from the Department of Labor and the Division of Insurance that will be available for questions, and I believe at least one statement. But Representative Millett, followed by Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I recently went through a series of back problems, and I was actually shocked, to tell you the truth, about the supply of opiates that they would give me on a 90-day supply. I mean, I'm talking, you know, Dilaudid, Valium, Ecstasy. I'm not Ecstasy. Xanax. I mean, there's Xanax. But what I was so surprised about is that 90 days supply of opiates, I don't have to see my doctor for 90 days. Now, obviously, I'm in pain, and I take them at night, and I take them in the morning before I come to work. As the speaker pointed out, some days I'm out here till 10. And I'm not on a workman's comp claim. I just didn't happen when I was at work. But when it does happen at work, I feel like there is a distinct responsibility for us to keep our workers' comp claims down. And, I mean, even I would prefer not to have the 90-day supply, although it's convenient for me. But a 30-day supply is more than enough for a person to, 30 days before you go see the doctor, if it's an ongoing workman's comp claim and it truly is something that you need, I mean, I'm astonished that we haven't done this previously, because one of the biggest problems that we have with APD right now is the sale of prescription drugs, illegal prescription drugs. I will tell you, and I know this because one of my pill bottles got stolen. And, the insurance, it's reported the insurance company will not pay for another prescription unless you report it to the police officers. So, I can't believe that we're just getting there now, because first I was astonished that they said that they'd give me a 90-day supply. I felt uncomfortable having that many opiates in my possession. I mean, it is really astonishing. I can show you my pill bottles. You'd be shocked on the amount of opiates that is. And so for us to... And I'm not on a workers' comp claim, but for us to be paying for a 90-day supply of some of these drugs that are upwards of $2,000, some of the drugs that are taking, and not having control over them or not having them check back in with their doctors for continuation of care, because that's what they need to be doing on a workman's comp claim, is a continuation of care with the outcome of them being able to go back to work. And so I guess my point is, I appreciate this legislation, and it wasn't until I had a back problem that I understood, what a 90-day supply of drugs look like. I've never had 90-day supply of anything, antibiotics are 5 days, 10 days, but man, they're extra large pill bottles, and if you're not taking them and your UA shows you're not taking them, you're not in pain. So I'm appreciative of this bill, and I think to question whether we're trying to make a criminal or not, I think what we're trying to do is keep illegal drugs off the streets, and that's how I see this bill, and making sure that people that are truly on workman's comp are using those drugs in an efficient manner to get them back to a place where they can be back gainfully employed and off the workers' comp. That's one of our, it's one of our big expenditures in the state, even for our employers. So,
thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Question for the sponsor staffer. It's kind of a top line of questioning here real quick. How accurate are the UAs or blood tests or the drug tests? If you're going to be doing these tests to find out if a workers' comp patient has not been taking their prescribed medications, how long does that person have to be from their last dose? How accurate is the test? How much gush factor is there, I guess?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's an excellent question. I will have to refer back to the statute that they fall under and look to the companies that are accredited to administer those tests, and I will get back to you on that.
I strongly suspect it varies according to the prescription medicine, how strong it is, how big a dose, et cetera. But just kind of clean to know how accurate it can be, because there's likely to be legal challenges down the road about workers' comp. So knowing how accurate the test is might forestall some of those.
I'm thinking there might be somebody in the room in a few minutes.
I'm thinking there is.
But Representative Schnell.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know where to start. I think you've got the makings of a good bill, but some of it I think may need to go even farther. Representative Millett was talking about how many pills you could carry around because she has a 90-day supply. There's people out there on the street that will kill you for that amount of drugs. And I've seen through my time in my community illicit drugs become a problem. I think we need to do everything we can at our level to make sure that those drugs stay where they're supposed to be. Should some of these folks fall in under a UA? I think maybe they should. If their system shows that they're not using them, and Representative Josephson talked about, could there be a lawsuit because maybe they decided they didn't need as many as they were being prescribed? That's a good thing. But if they're continuing to get a full prescription of those drugs, then the next question has to be is where are they going? I know when my mother died, she had a prescription for OxyContin, and she probably had at least 100 OxyContin tablets at her house. Now, I was glad that nobody knew they were there and nobody broke in, because, as I said earlier, people get killed over a lot less than that. And so, there has to be a way to control these pills that can get out into the open market, because they do. And not only do they lead to problems with legal medical drugs, a lot of times that turns into something even worse than what the medical drug may do. So I like where this is going. I haven't looked at it real close, but I hope that you've got another piece of legislation somewhere there, because if these folks are selling their drugs out on the streets that workers' comp's paying for, or that state's paying for, they need to be held accountable. So I know that's not in here, but these folks need to be accountable for their actions.
I'm sure if you want to work on an amendment, we're definitely not moving it in the next few days, but
I can find another piece of legislation to attach it to, Mr. Chairman.
Are you saying I'm in danger?
No, I'm not saying you're in danger.
You just got done saying that people will kill for
that. Representative Herron.
You are in danger. You're not a danger. You could be in danger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And I'm going to echo what a lot of people are saying, is that I think this is a good measure. That's 30 days is a normal medication for a lot of even non-opiates. So I guess the only thing is, just by the sheer side of this size of the state, is this would be rigid, and it may prove impracticable for some, right?
Representative Herron, through the chair, the contact with the physician is not defined in the legislation. So whether it's an office visit by phone, that hasn't been defined in the legislation. So that wouldn't mandate someone coming from a small community to visit a doctor. But there, as far as mailing out to smaller villages, that would be possible as long as there was contact, I believe, because it hasn't been defined there.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chairman is...
No, Mr. Speaker.
Yeah, I'm reminded of it all the time. But I just wanted on the record that, you know, is it can't be so rigid, though in most cases it can be rigid, and it's probably, if it's important for society, that it is. But obviously, you know, listening to it, is that the doctor needs to know if there really truly is a pain medication that's necessary. But the abuses are, you know, this currently, the abuse is convenient, the abuse of not taking it and making money off of it, sort of, is one example. But again, just for the record, I want to make sure that there are smart ways of not having a physical relationship in very few cases because of the size of our state.
And if you can, again, the bill is going to be around for a few days, and if you can think of something that you want into it, we would certainly entertainment.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Speaker, on that point, is that's the key, is that though I respect trying to have a rigid process that limits the amount for the people that really need it, but at the same time, is there an option that we could consider? And in a lot of ways, it might be impractical. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll talk. Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Latham, have you seen any statistics at all that say abuse of opioids is greater among workers' comp claimants than all the other segments of society?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I have not seen particular statistics that show that abuse in workers' comp claims are higher than widespread abuse. The trends tend to mirror each other as far as what's happening at the nationally with just in general is very similar to the workers' comp claims as far as abuse. But I haven't seen any statistics that show that workers' comp claims exceed just what's happening nationally.
One follow-up?
Sure. One follow-up. Wouldn't a wise amendment then be that this rule, this principle, apply to all Alaskans?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, that would probably be a tough sell, but the bill will be brought back up. If you'd like to offer an amendment, legislators.
Any further questions for Ms. Latham? Thanks again, Anna. And as I mentioned, we're going to be no intention of moving the bill in the next few days, but I'd like to open up testimony, starting with Lori. Larry Wang. Oh, we have a new name, don't we?
I have a name. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lori Wang Heyer. I am the director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Workers' compensation is certainly a Department of Labor statute, but the employers tend to fund their obligation under the statute by purchasing insurance. The Division of Insurance, of course, sets those rates. When we're talking the cost, the rates that we're setting by the Division of Insurance are impacted by the cost of prescriptions through workers' compensation claims. As you've heard before, Alaska right now has the distinction of having the highest workers' compensation rate overall in the state of in the nation. When we break down the cost or the number of claims or the type of claims we're looking at, as medical claims were 43 out of 46, and as indemnity claims, which are generally your longer-term claims with the higher injury, were 29 out of 46. It may not look bad, but it's nothing to be proud of either. When I looked at some of the historical data going back in the last 5 years, Alaska should expect for every 100,000 workers to have about 4,800 claims. Of those 4,800 claims, 1,400 will be long-term claims, and these are the claimants that we're talking about that would have the long-term prescriptions. The costs have increased steadily in the data that I've looked at going back to 2007. In 2007, and this is averages again, it was $190 per claim. It's now $265. Most injured employees are receiving up to 6 prescriptions, which is, this is not including renewals, but as you're talking about, 6 prescriptions for an injury. The top 10 drugs that are being prescribed are pain medications. Of that, 25% is OxyContin. The statistics are staggering, and employers, through their workers' compensation costs, are paying for these. And all I can say to this body is that we are watching the cost of workers' compensation. We're trying as best we can, working with the Department of Labor and others, to get it under control and affordable for the employers. And we hope you take a look at Bill 370. And the impact that we're looking for is a reduction in the rates. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy.
Representative Joseph.
Thank you. Ms. Wing Heyer, first of all, just a little housekeeping. I thought there was a different director of insurance. I thought you were the director.
Marty.
That's acting director.
You guys work it out.
I think it's been worked out.
Ms. Wing Heyer, when I hear that the average injured worker has been prescribed 6 medications. Did I hear that right?
Yes, you did, sir.
Okay. It must be that to the extent this is a problem, and it may very well be, that the medical community is absolutely complicit in the problem. Don't you agree?
Through the chair, I would not disagree with that statement. I would hate to think that there's complicity in it. But I do think that statistics prove that prescription drugs are overprescribed, and that they are also the high amount that are prescribed, the 30-day supply that we've talked about, that more often you see the 90-day supply or longer prescribed for convenience, for whatever reason, that there is an issue with the overprescribing of the medications.
Can I follow up on that?
Representative Millett.
Just through our insurance program through Aetna, I believe we're only allowed to get up to a 3-month prescription at a time. So like when I've gone to refill my prescriptions, I can't get another prescription. It has to hit that 90-day mark before I will be authorized to have another prescription. So our insurance right now doesn't allow for prescriptions longer than 90 days. I believe that's correct.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, that's through our personal or our employer-sponsored health plan.
Right.
Workers' compensation, I do not know, and perhaps the Department of Labor could answer, I do not know of any limitation within the statutes of what they can prescribe.
Follow up.
No. Representative Schnall.
No, let it go away.
Okay.
So under a workers' compensation plan, they could prescribe up to a year of pain medication?
Through the chair, Representative Mel, I don't know that they wouldn't. I have not heard of anyone prescribing a year, but I am aware of prescriptions that have been for, let's assume that a 90-day supply was 90 pills or 120. I have seen bills come across when I was working more the insurance side for longer or larger amounts than that.
That is unbelievable. Sorry.
Representative Schnault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said six scripts. Is that six of the same scripts, or is that six different scripts is the average that a workers' comp injured person would pick up?
Through the chair, Representative Schnault, that is six prescriptions different, six different kinds.
Okay.
So
and you know, not
Paula?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and never, fortunately for me, ever being on the work comp system. Does it sound odd that I would think that a doctor would want to see an employee that had been injured within 90 days to make sure that maybe they were healing, or that they were either getting better or getting worse, versus just giving them a 90-day script and sending them on their way? I mean, to me, that makes more sense. And maybe we'll have some doctors at some point in time, Mr. Chairman, but, you know, I know in my own community, I think that we have doctors that write too many scripts. And I don't know if you've ever done any investigation into any the number of scripts that a doctor writes for a specific drug versus the normal average. I don't know if they've had any type of a report done like that, but I'd be interested in knowing that.
Through the chair, Representative Schnault, I know of no study that has been done to see what the doctors are prescribing, or to answer your question. Unfortunately, as Anna said earlier, it's an epidemic throughout the nation. We're seeing some negative impacts in Alaska. We're hoping that this bill will start to address it, particularly as it respects the cost. I don't know, as I sit here today, and part of what you're asking me goes well, way before my time as being the director of the Division of Insurance, and I apologize for that. I could get back to you with the data.
Mr. Chairman, just a short follow-up. No, I just, you know, I look at it and I go, okay, if we're concerned about what our work comp costs are, but the first thing we do is give an injured employee a script and then tell them to come back in 90 days because that's when their script runs out, maybe we are the problem.
Through the chair, Representative Schnault, I would think that it would be best practices for the physicians to see them.
And Mr. Chairman, if I just might follow up, and no disparaging remarks toward the doctors, but to me it just sounds odd. You know, if I go to the doctor and I've got something going on with me, I might get a 10-day, you know, come back in 10 days and let me look at you. That would be normal. And then if I was still injured, still having a problem, then they would maybe give me a script for a longer period of time, but and maybe they don't do that originally, just give you a 90-day script. Maybe they only give you a month, or I don't know, but I know there is a problem there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that's why we have the bill.
We have one more question.
Representative Herron, then Representative Watt.
So, Mr. Chairman, I guess it's just following the speaker's comments. And so when I go to the Heart Institute, I visit with my doctor, and then I'm prescribed non-opiates for my heart condition, and that is usually good for, say, 10 months, but the max I can get is a 90-day prescription. So when it comes to opiates, you go see your doc, the claimant's doc. Is it that you have to see him, say, in 10 months, your next visit is scheduled for 10 months? So now we want to have the maximum of 30 days, but should, in best practices, another piece of legislation, should it be, in your opinion, should it be where you can't have that long of a time between one visit and the next visit? Should that those times be much shorter? Should maximum of 3 months, but with three 30-day prescriptions? In other words, you can't get more until the first 30 days is out. In your opinion, shouldn't we narrow it there?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I don't disagree with that getting tighter controls would be better. I don't know that we can do that, but I think perhaps the tighter the controls, the more we might see the impact on the rates being charged to the employers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Watt.
So my question follows Representative Herron's question. So in our workers' comp regulations, we don't require people on workman's comp to visit their doctor. There's no requirements for them to see their doctor every 30 days. I mean, how do we know when our workers are getting better if we're not requiring them to see their physician and give a report? I mean, how do we connect progress and wellness if they're not seeing their physicians? Let's just say they get a 90-day prescription, they go back to and they've been well for 45 days. I mean, I guess I don't understand why there's no regulations for them. If you're on workman's comp and you're missing work and we're paying your medical bills, why we wouldn't require them to have more office visits to track their progress? That seems like it would be a cost savings, and it would be an ability for workers' comp costs to go down, because you'd find that patients are actually, after 30 days of rest or whatever the complication or whatever the workers' comp accident was, that maybe after 30 days the doctor would release them to come back to work.
Through the chair, Representative Nutt. In workers' compensation, we have kind of a third party, the adjuster, involved to monitor the employee and when they go to the doctor and how long they are off work. And they work in conjunction with the doctor to see what the doctor states the progress has been, as well as the employee, the injured employee. That being said, I don't know of any part of the work comp legislation or regulation that states that the injured employee must go to the doctor every 30 days. So if it were a long-term injury, he or she might not see their doctor every 30 days, but they would be involved with the adjuster monitoring their progress.
Okay.
Brief? Yes. I had your name. I'm determined to find it. Ms. Ware Hine?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have any data relative to costs associated with requiring more frequent visits? In other words, that would drive costs up, seemingly. And I ask this because just 2 days ago we had a bill, and the motivation behind the bill is to decrease visits and have more sort of quick prescriptions. So I'm trying to get a sense of where's the culture going here? Are we trying to do telemedicine, or are we trying to increase visits to monitor injured people?
I think I can answer that. Our intent is to get the employee back to work. There'll be a cost savings associated with it by getting them back to work and getting them off of a drug that was developed to be basically an end-of-life drug for terminal cancer patients, is what OxyContin was originally invented for and utilized for a long time until it became a vehicle to make the pain go away, and anybody that has a backache or something else and it's being over-prescribed. Most people realize that, but our intent is having the people get back to work. Ultimately, that's what saves us and saves them and every employer money, the families. But once you're on OxyContin or any of the serious opioids for a lengthy period of time, you don't end up going back to work for one reason or another. And with that, I want to thank you, Lori, and I'd like to bring Mike Montegal up. Mike does not have a prepared statement, but I think we probably touched on a few things that he has answers for, I hope.
And just for clarification, we're not advocating telemedicine for workman's comp claims. I think we're talking about apples and oranges. I don't think telemedicine is part of the workman's comp claim.
I don't know.
It's not.
Thank you.
I can answer that.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Mike Monagle. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. There were a few questions that were asked I can answer. One question was, do injured workers have to see a doctor on a regular basis? There is a provision in law that says that the employer can require an injured worker to see the doctor at least once every 2 weeks. the director of Vision of Insurance had testified to, most of the time cases are managed by a claims administrator. I will tell you that the workload for most companies is that a specific claims adjuster typically handles over 100 cases. They tend to pay more attention to those serious indemnity claims than a medical-only claim. But they do have the ability to direct an injured worker to see their doctor at least once every 2 weeks. Obviously, if you've had surgery and the normal recovery time for that surgery is 6 to 8 weeks, it probably would not make sense to have them go see the doctor. One of the other questions is, how is the problem in comp greater than general health care? And while we don't have any hard data on that, there is data out, a study by the Workers' Comp Research Institute last year indicated that for a time loss claim, so you're missing work, the average number of workers' comp workers who receive opiate prescriptions is over 75%. Intuitively, that makes sense. You've got a strain, you've got a break, you've got something going on with your body that's creating pain. So it's not unreasonable to assume that you would have a need for a pain prescription. I think what the sponsor had spoken to in comp, the problem is the longer you are on these pain medications, the longer you miss work. For people who have been on opiate prescriptions, painkiller prescriptions, for more than 90 days, the duration of their disability, the amount of time they're off work, is at least 30% higher than those who are not taking these opiates. Personally, I have read cases that have come before workers' comp where some injured workers with serious disabilities have been on opiates for 2 and 3 years. You read the doctor's comments, the doctors recognize this person's addicted. The doctor recognizes that the dosage, the morphine equivalent dose, is going up and up and up. They recognize the person is starting to suffer mental disabilities because of prolonged use of this drug, physical disabilities, yet it's the only thing that they can keep doing, so they keep prescribing these drugs. So it is a problem. That the Centers for Disease Control uses the term epidemic, and they don't use that lightly. So in workers' comp, it is a reflection of the general health care system, but I think we tend to see more pronounced problems with it in comp than perhaps general health care.
And for the committee, this bill is a result of a meeting that Director Monagle and I attended last year, put on by the Workers' Comp Research Institute, and it turned out this was 90% of the meeting and the problems that were going on in the states, and the fact that opioid fatalities from operating a vehicle is getting real close, if it hasn't passed drunk driving, for driver fatalities. It's a serious problem. But anybody, Representative Josephson, do you have a question for Director?
No, I do, and I don't know if there's an AG that you work with closely. These cases from the Supreme Court, there's one called Peronia, which is about testing student athletes in Oregon, and there's another one about customs officers, people who do border stops. And there's another one about railroad workers, and we saw a horrific New York State, Long Island, I think it was not Long Island, but New York State railroad disaster. Those are positions where drug testing I would defend, because you've got to have it. What would be the public interest here? I understand one comment might be reduce rates, reduce premiums, good for business, and maybe that's the answer. But the worker, if he's injured and at home, he's not posing a threat to anybody but maybe himself, apparently. Is that right? I mean, so I guess, have you talked to anybody at the AG's office about the legality, even if there is an issue here, about the legality of the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I have not talking to our agency AG about it. I believe that the purpose for the testing, as previous testimony indicated, is that in states that have adopted testing, they're finding up to 30% or higher of the folks that are being prescribed these drugs aren't taking them. They're not showing up in their urinalysis test. And those drugs, the assumption is, are making it on the street. There's nothing that that says that the employer has to prosecute or that there would be any type of criminal action. Now, some states have adopted what they call Good Samaritan or Safe Harbor laws that if a person is reported by a loved one, a spouse, a family member, that they have a substance abuse problem and they're doing something like that, could allow for some type of intervention or program to assist them without criminal charges being involved. But since this affects, from what I've read here, Title 23 only, that I don't think it has any criminal intent or criminal prosecution behind it.
Representative Joseph, if I could refer you to page 1, line 7 and 8. An employer may require an employee. It's discretionary. It's not a mandate.
Right.
And it's after 90 days.
Yes.
I mean, it's not... We're not going out with a chainsaw, and we're going more on a scalpel basis rather than a chainsaw and addressing the problem. I mean, if I had my way, this bill would be more in line with what Speaker Chenault and Representative Millett were indicating, but we're doing something that we felt was reasonable. We ran this by a number of people, including our legal staff, and we spent countless hours with Director Monagle on this issue. For being a short bill, a little over a page. It's a good, or in my opinion only, it's a good start.
Actually, if I may?
Totally
new question. Mr. Monagle, the bill is very short, and I notice an absence of a lot of things, an absence of ramifications for employment, HIPAA issues, due process. I'm thinking of baseball. My father and I have had these conversations. People violated, they didn't violate a law or a rule of Major League Baseball, and there was no penalty. They created penalties. There's no penalty here. What's the plan if the test shows a lower than should be their dosage of opiates?
Yeah, through the chair. Typically in workers' comp system, everything revolves around the payment of benefits. So if a injured worker is prescribed a supply of these narcotics and he gets tested and they do not show up, the approach some states take is to say that they will not continue to pay for that prescription drug. Unless there is some convincing evidence that, it was stolen, they reported it to the police, or some other substantial evidence that that prescription should be refilled. But if it's not showing up in the UA testing, most states that would handle that would simply say that particular benefit is cut off. It doesn't impact the rest of that particular claimant's access to medical care or disability benefits that they may have. It's just that that particular benefit would be cut off. As far as employment provisions, I'm not as familiar with that, but I believe that there is a provision under the employment statute that says if the employer is applying drug testing as part of its employment practices, that there are safeguards from suits being filed against the employer for that purpose. And I know many employers have zero drug tolerance policies, and if there's drug testing and other things show up, whether or not they could take disciplinary action because of that, I couldn't tell you for sure.
Mike, could you give us a ballpark on what percentage of the Alaska workforce is already subject to UAs?
Mr. Chairman,
just a wild guess.
I don't. I even hate to offer a wild guess.
But it would be people in transportation industry, people in the maritime, at least licensed people in the maritime industry, and most of the people on the North Slope, I believe, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chairman, I really don't know. I don't have any numbers on that.
But with that, representing Sadler, and then we're not building bill over. We're not doing anything today.
Thank you, Chair.
Well, we are doing something, but not moving it.
Obviously, this seems to be an obvious bill on its face. It seems to make sense, and it's a compelling narrative that you've laid out in the background materials as well. And the benefits would also seem to be clear. I got two brief questions, though. You said that workers' comp patients who are on leave from work or claims for a long time tend to be those who are on pain meds. Are we confusing causality? Is it just the people who have serious injuries who require pain meds? For that reason, they're longer claims or longer off work? Is that a fair?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Sadler. Part of the problem with being on opiates for a long time, and I think most of the medical community and the workers' comp community really is concerned about long-term use. I don't think too many people are concerned with a 30-day supply, which is why I think the bill says you can have up to a 30-day supply. What concerns people in comp is that the longer you're on these things, your tolerance to pain and discomfort tends to go up. So you need more medication. The threshold a lot of states use is 120 milligrams of morphine equivalent. If you've reached that dosage, and there's not a medical reason, I think somebody else had asked, you know, isn't it reasonable to be seeing your doctor and have your doctor ask questions on how you're progressing? And I think it's a valid question. I mean, if you've reached that sort of dosage, if you've been on these painkillers for more than 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, there's no functional improvement, there's no benefit that anybody can see that you're getting out of taking these drugs, why isn't something being done to try to start you, to wean you down off these pain medications so that you don't become addicted and start developing all these other issues? Now, this particular bill doesn't address that. It just simply says through regulations that the division can put some things into play. Now, whether that's within the scope of the statutory authority, I don't know. But certainly that's the concern is long-term use of opiates.
I can see that. Thank you. Well, pending application, I'm going to squeeze in a couple for one more. I also agree with the Representative Schnell, who's here, that I can see the common sense of this for other practices of medicine, but 30-day supply seems to be decent. I'm not a doctor. But my other question is, in looking at the large list of Schedule 1A drugs, I never knew there were so many drugs in the world, and I can't pronounce half of them. Is it appropriate to have this limited just to Schedule 1? Looking at Schedule 2, there also looks like there's hallucinogenic and some pain relief. Are you comfortable that the Schedule 1 is as far as you should cut the score?
Yeah, through the chair, I believe it's in the second page. It's 1A, the 3A, and the 5A would be subject to that.
Right, one last question. Yep. This might not be the right one. Is it my understanding that Schedule 1, 2, 3 is just degrees of intensity or strength or effectiveness? Or are there different categories? Schedule 1 is pain relief. Schedule 2 is hallucinogenic. Schedule 3 is, I don't know, antibiotic.
Through the chair, it's my understanding that these are various concentrations of the opiate or opiate derivatives. So class 1 would be the one that proposes the greatest threat to life and health, particularly if used in wrong combination with other drugs.
So it's appropriate to be number 1 is the most powerful, so that's what you should. Okay, good. Thanks.
Representative Millett.
Thank you. So my question is a hypothetical situation. Someone has a serious back injury. I am choosing to delay my surgery till after session. What about the person who just decides that they don't want to have surgery so they can continue on the opiate and never return to work? I mean, at some point, there has to be a decision. I mean, you can't make someone have surgery to correct their spine, but ultimately you'll be paying for that workman's comp claim for time until it ends if they don't take the doctor's recommendation to have surgery. My doctor recommended fusion. I'm going to do it as soon as I leave this building because I'm uncomfortable and I want to work. But what about those people that don't want to work and that would rather take opiates? How long can they go on when their first opinion is you need to have your spine fused, your second opinion is you need to have your spine fused? How long does workers' comp continue down the path of opiates as the answer when the real answer would be an invasive procedure?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Millett, I think that the consensus in the medical community from what I've read is that a person may want to undergo conservative care, physical therapy, and other types of conservative treatment before surgery, and I understand that. But I don't think it's in anybody's best interest, including the injured worker, to stay on opiates indefinitely. And so what states are doing with that is if a person says, surgery is just not an option for me, I just don't believe that that's what I want to do, then there ought to be a plan in place. And in fact, states are requiring that after a prescribed period of time, that there be a plan in place working with your doctor to step you down on the level of opiates from 120 milligram of morphine equivalent and get it down below that number and eventually be weaned off of it and probably attend a pain management clinic and learn alternate ways to deal with your pain. But I think, as the speaker said, these drugs were never intended to be long-term drugs. It was an end-of-life care, really. And they were supposed to be short-term use, not intended to be long-term use. And the problem has come really from the long-term use of these drugs.
Follow-up? Well, there's other drugs other than Oxycontin that have that same opiate effect. I mean, morphine, Dilaudid. I mean, those are highly addictive medications and can be prescribed for, you know, time and time and time. And at some point, I mean, I guess maybe that's something that I should talk to the sponsor about, but at some time, I know people that move from workman's comp because they don't want to have the surgery to disability, when the answer would likely be to go have your spine fused and you would be, I mean, you'd be cured. I mean, I'm of the thought that my spine's going to be cured in May. I mean, I'm done, and that's it. But there is another philosophy of people that get on opiates that don't want to have the surgery, that want to continue down the path and eventually get to disability. How do you manage that transition, and how do you keep them from going down that path where we're still on the dole for, we change from workman's comp to disability benefits?
Yeah, through the chair. Those are the 1% cases. I mean, that the system spends a lot of its resources on those tough cases. But again, I just don't think it would be in that person's best interest to ever stay on these types of drugs for the remainder of their life. Chronic pain management is basically what you're talking about. And I think in chronic pain management, the general consensus in the industry is that they're working with the patient in ways to minimize their need for these types of drugs. And the term that's generally used is opiate equivalents, because you're correct. I mean, the type of OxyContin, although it's OxyContin HCL, I think is in about 80% of the different types of drugs out there. When you talk about opiate equivalents, everything is based on, you know, what that type of dose can do.
Right. Okay.
Sounds like you might be a volunteer to help me next year on best practices.
I would, and I mean, my eyes got opened when, you know, my back broke. I mean, it was just phenomenal for me because I had never, I mean, it was the amount of abuse that can be done is phenomenal to me. And so I think that when we talk about workman's comp, we should have those in-depth conversations, and it should be about getting the worker back healthy and working.
Thanks again, Mike. And with that, I'm going to open it up to public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify? Seeing none, we have nobody online, but we are holding public testimony open, and we will hold this call up for further discussion. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease. Would you like to testify?
Yeah, just briefly.
Please come up. Hello, Liz.
Unfortunately, I've been through the workers' comp system. I fell on the ice and was severely injured.
Oh, could you please state your name and affiliation for the record?
My apologies. Through the chair. Representative Olson. My name is Sydney C. And I worked for the university in procurement 5-10 years ago. I worked there for a long time. I fell on the ice right outside the door. I ended up with 2 wrist surgeries, a shoulder surgery. 10 months later, they discovered I had severed my rotator cuff and almost 2 muscles. Right after that, they discovered I'd also done a disc. So then I had a 3-level neck surgery. Well, the money in workers' comp, in my opinion, is going to the adjusters. They get the top paid lawyers, and you get the top doctors to come up and give you what's called a IME, independent medical exam. Mm-hmm. I went through several of these. They must cost probably $10,000 each just to do that. But unfortunately, when I was moving boxes at the RIO in Anchorage in October 31st, I hurt my lower back. I already am established with an excellent doctor. He's never prescribed more than 30 days, even when I had neck surgery. And he always has me sign an annual form, and they do random drug tests to make sure their patients are not abusing drugs. If you've never had spinal pain, all I can say is it's ungodly, and I pray you never do. Well, fortunately, my lumbar problem does not, at this point, appear to be a big deal. That was October 31st. Well, the Northern Adjusters has already scheduled me for what's the IME, the Independent Medical Exam. They're flying a doctor up here from San Diego. I'm like, is this financially responsible? I'm just appalled. I mean, this problem should probably be resolved within a matter of time. I'm getting good treatment. My doctor does give me some injections in the lower back. My goal is to work and to work effectively. But I don't think that the big cost is the prescriptions. I've never had a doctor anywhere give me more than 30 days, so I'm interested in who you went to. Not that I would go to them, because my doctors have always been extremely ethical. And even my general practitioner that I've gone to for 30 years, no one in that clinic will prescribe pain medication. They send you to the pain clinic, the ones that are experts. So I have a lot of knowledge in this area. I would love to share more of it. I would love to see the system changed. It's unfortunate that a lot of the patients, if you do have to get a lawyer, you get the bottom lawyer, because they only get paid if they win. So how many of them are going to be out there doing that? Whereas the insurance adjuster, their lawyers always get paid, so they're going to have the best lawyer. And I guess that concludes my testimony. I'd be glad to provide more details. It's just been a frustrating road. You know, my whole fall thing took 5 years. And at one point, they made me do a whole year of pain procedures before they would do the surgery. I had a disc replacement and 2 fusions. And fortunately, I had a wonderful job at procurement. My boss and my co-employees were very supportive. But the insurance adjuster was not, so, which was the university. So, well, anyway, that's the end of my testimony.
I really appreciate you coming forward and testifying, and it helps us get a perspective on exactly what the situation is.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to fix. It. Our goal is to get people back to work as fast as we can.
My goal is to work.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Anybody else in the room? Seeing none, we're going to hold public testimony over and take a brief at ease and get ready for the next bill. Back in the record, next item on the calendar today, last item, is House Bill 152. We first heard this bill on April 5th and then again on the 10th. During the last meeting, we adopted the CS version Y, and then we took public testimony and set the bill aside. With us today is a sponsor, Representative Thompson and Jane Pearson. We've also asked Mike Barnhill, who I hope is right behind us. Right in front of us, depending on where you're sitting. And first off, Jane, could you walk us through real briefly what the bill does, you know, like the 30,000 foot?
Chairman Olson, for the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. And what this bill does from the 30,000 foot perspective is it really does away with termination studies. It's the cost associated with obtaining a termination study, the actuarial cost to the employer for future benefits, to employees whose coverage is terminated, and the past service costs annually on each position terminated until the unfunded obligation is paid off decades from now. And that's really what this bill does.
That's good enough for me. And the intent is to get Mike Barnhill up really to explain the new fiscal note that came with the CS that we adopted.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Are we looking at version Y?
Yeah.
Okay. From February 26th. Just so we're looking at the right bill.
Yeah, 152.
Okay.
Welcome back, Mr. Barnhill.
Good afternoon, Mr.
Deputy
Chair.
Commissioner Barnhill.
Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration. Just shortly prior to the last hearing, we put in a fiscal note. We did not have the backup from Buck at the time we put it in. We've since got that today. I believe it's been circulated to the committee. There's some amount of complexity with how this fiscal note has been computed, and I will confess that I was confused when the $75 million number came in just prior to the last hearing, so I apologize if I have misled anybody on the committee or in the room with respect to what this means. So just to back up a bit and explain about termination studies and what they do. When an employer terminates a group classification or department under current statute, a termination study is required, and the termination study and costs cover there are three different items of cost. First is the cost of the termination study itself, which ranges between $2,500 and $5,000 per study. The employer has to pay that. The second basket of cost is the new unfunded liability that is created when a group of employees terminates. Under Alaska statute, when you're terminated from PERS service, you have the option of either refunding your PERS balance or immediately vesting. The actuary assumes that some of these folks, maybe all of them, will immediately vest. And when folks immediately vest and that vesting date is prior to the anticipated date of retirement, there's an unfunded liability associated with that because we haven't had enough time or we haven't had the anticipated time to collect all the funds we need from the employee and the employer to pay their expected benefit. So there's a new unfunded liability that's created. Then the third basket of costs that's under the current statute is when an employer terminates a group classification or a department. For that group of employees, the employer must pay the entire past service liability cost, not the capped under the 22%, but the entire amount until the unfunded liability is entirely extinguished. Right now we're projecting that will be in 2031. Various PERS employers have objections to the current statute, which was enacted, I believe, in 2008 as part of SB 125. They have brought forth concerns about this impairs their ability to be flexible with their payroll, or they'd like to make some changes, or they'd like not to incur the various termination costs that I just described. We've recognized those concerns and we've attempted to work with them. But the fact of the matter is there will be cost shifting. However we change this, there will be cost shifting to the state. Last year, the version of the bill had a sliding scale threshold for when termination studies would kick in. And under the previous version of the bill, the sliding scale depended on how large the payroll was. So for large employers, $5 million or more in annual payroll, they would have to terminate 20% or more of their payroll before a termination study would kick in. Anything under that, if there was new unfunded liability or there was past service costs shifted to the state would pick that up. For medium-sized employers from $1 million to $5 million in payroll, the threshold was 50%. Employer would have to terminate up to 50% or more of their payroll in order for the termination study requirement to kick in. And for small employers, $1 million or less in payroll, the state would just pick it all up. What PAC did when they computed the fiscal note for last year's version of the bill, there's some, and there may be other ways of doing this, but this is how PAC did it. They first assumed, let's just say that all employers terminate all PERS employees out of PERS service. What will be the new unfunded liability created when we do that? That is, the unfunded liability that is created when someone retires earlier than expected. And what Buck came up with was that would cost $375 million, meaning the system, because of these early retirements, was unable to collect $375 million because people retired early. Then what they did under the prior version of the bill was allocate that under that sliding scale threshold. And Buck computed that the state would end up picking up $99 million of that. Employers would pick up $376 million of that. So the $99 million that the state would pick up was by virtue of the amounts that under the sliding scale. So for instance, for $1 million, for employers with $1 million of payroll or less, the state picks up all of that new unfunded liability. For employers with $1 to $5 million in payroll, the state will pick up 50% of that. And then 20% for the large employers. Now, Buck made another assumption, and that was, even though we start with, okay, what happens when 100% of employees are pulled out of PERS service, that doesn't seem reasonable, that's not going to happen. So instead, and this is the assumption they've had from the beginning on this bill, is that employers would only take 20% out. Now, we can discuss and debate whether 20% is too conservative or too liberal an assumption, but that's just the number that Buck has used. So that $99 million that the state would pick up, Buck said 20% of that will fall to the state, which is roughly $20 million. In addition to that $20 million, there's also the past service cost that shifts to the state. And the reason why the past service cost shifts to the state payroll shrinks, the amount of past service costs that are collected from employers also shrinks. So if you've got an employer who's got a payroll of $1 million and they cut out 20% of their payroll and so their payroll shrinks to $800,000, then you're applying that 22% contribution rate on $800,000 instead of $1 million, you're collecting less money. You're collecting less money for past service. The state then picks up that differential. So the fiscal note last year on page one showed a variety of annual costs. The first line was for the retroactive effect of the bill, which is no longer the case in version Y. The second line was for the past service costs associated with shifting that to the state by virtue of a smaller payroll. And then the third line is the new past service costs associated with the new unfunded liability, which Buck computed would be $25 million. That's the reasoning and the methodology behind last year's fiscal note. It's fairly complex. This year, under version Y, the sponsor has taken a different approach, and that is to simply repeal the requirement for termination costs and termination studies altogether. Under this version of the bill, all of the costs would shift to the state. Recall again, Buck has said if all employees terminate out of poor service, that's a new unfunded liability of $375 million. We know not all are going to do it, so Buck is assuming 20% will terminate. 20% of 375 is $75 million. So that is the background to the $75 million new unfunded liability that we put in our fiscal note last week and is reflected on page 2 of this letter. Now again, by shrinking payrolls across the board by 20%, that's that amount of that the payroll is that amount smaller, and therefore that amount is not available to compute past service costs on, and those also shift to the state. In the letter that I just handed out to the committee, there are again three lines on page 1. The first line is incorrect, and we're going to need to have Buck update that. I got this letter 5 minutes before I walked over here and did not have time to correct it with Buck. But under the current version, version Y, there is no retroactive effect in the bill, and so I believe that we can delete that line. The second line is the existing past service liability that would be shifted to the state by virtue of smaller payrolls, smaller municipal payrolls. And then the third line is the new past service liability associated with the $75 million new unfunded liability by virtue of people retiring early, earlier than anticipated. Very complex, and I'm sure there are questions, and I'm happy to attempt to answer them.
Representative Heron?
No, Mr. Chairman, but I mean...
As a former city manager, we have no questions.
Well, this is difficult. Me and Amy Luan, of course, we were both used to be on the Alaska Public Entities Insurance Board, and we're really concerned about this. But that's why I handed you that note that maybe we should take a look at what we're using as the base in 2008, and should that window be defined, and should we move along in history? But other than that, I mean, we need to talk about that as well.
Well, we've got Mike right here as a sounding board.
So, I guess what me and Amy were having this conversation today, and so everything's based upon the 2008 legislation, and that's where we start. I guess, and you know, this hasn't been a full conversation, but shouldn't we define a window now, say a six-year window, and then every year we go forward, shouldn't that window be updated? So it goes to next, say this year it would be 2009, next year it will be 2010 as the base.
Andy. Through the chair, Representative Heron, I think there's a whole variety of approaches we could use to accomplish the objective of the 2008 legislation, which was essentially to prevent or limit cost shifting from municipalities to the state. And the reason why that was done was because the state was picking up a fair amount of additional liability through the form of state assistance under SB 125. As I testified previously, the states contributed over $600 million on behalf of municipalities to PERS. In the SB 125 legislation that was enacted in 2008, there were two ways that cost shifting was addressed. One was through the 2008 salary floor. So if a PERS employer payroll dips below the 2008 salary floor, that 22% employer contribution rate is computed on the 2008 payroll as opposed to the current payroll. That's one way. And then the second way was through the termination costs and study requirement. Both are important because the further we get out from 2008, if payrolls are growing at 3 to 5% a year, as they do, that 2008 salary floor becomes theoretically less and less meaningful. Now, for some PERS employers, the 2008 salary floor is quite meaningful because, in fact, their PERS payrolls have declined below the 2008 salary floor. But that's a handful of employers. There has been suggestion that there's bills, relief bills pending for the 2008 salary floor for municipalities like Galena, and you may well be right that it's worth at some point a fresh look at how best to preserve a certain portion of the payment of the unfunded liability within the PERS municipal employer community.
So, Mr. Paulo? Mr. Chairman, that was a good challenge for me to reflect on when I was city manager. And so I guess that's the fundamental question that that we're all facing is the 2008 legislation. So what was important at the time, but advanced 6 years now, and so is it relevant, that 125, is it relevant today?
Through the chair, Representative Heron, for certain employers, it's quite relevant. So the largest employer whose payroll has dipped below the 2008 salary floor is the University of Alaska. And that's primarily because they offer the ORP, other retirement program, to new professors, and it has a, I believe, a 14% employer contribution rate to a 401k style retirement plan, and that's pretty attractive.
Mr. Speaker, one more of a comment is that, of course, EPORS, Elected Public Officials Retirement System, is almost finished because all those legislators are slowly, unfortunately, dying away. Is what world would we have if we had EPORS in place? Because when you're a legislator in those days, is they were careful to craft in a provision that hardly anybody knows about. And so when I was city manager, a previous legislator that enjoyed EPORS would come to me every time I got a raise because he was a city manager for at least 1 year. And in EPORS, future city managers gave the EPOR legislators a raise. And so I, whenever that former legislator saw that his local city manager got a raise, EPORS gave him a raise as well to match.
And through the chair, 25 people covered under EPORS?
34 left. Yep. Yeah. That sort of linkage is also in the judicial retirement system. So every time we give the judges, current sitting judges, a raise, it also boosts the benefit for the retired judges.
Representative Josephson.
No, that helped me. The last comment. So, well, I mean,
want to be a judge?
Yeah, he's going to be a judge now.
That's based on ranking from fellow attorneys, and I don't know if I'd qualify. If at bottom, Mr. Barnhill, the March 18th letter, you had $75 million in the original fiscal note. This also says 75, doesn't it?
No, the original one through the chair said 25.
Well, no, but on page 2 of the narrative of the fiscal note, it indicates
from last year.
Well, it's printed March 15th. This may just be what you based this on. This may be the same.
Oh, I'm sorry. Our fiscal note. Right. Our fiscal note. I'm sorry. Through the chair, just to clarify this. Normally, when we have an actuarial impact, we deliver two documents. Mm-hmm. We deliver our fiscal note on fiscal note stationery, mm-hmm. and then the letter from the actuary as backup. Mm-hmm. So what we submitted last week was the fiscal note that had the $75 million. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the backup from the actuary, the letter that came in this afternoon.
Follow-up, new question?
Well, I'm pretty well convinced that smaller communities have a more serious problem with termination costs. I'm less convinced of the other, and I don't, I guess one of my concerns is if a deal was struck in 2008 and now the plan would be to back end these costs in 2031 or something, how do we know that that won't be revised and the state won't be on the hook?
Well, through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think what you're referring to is the notion that if the governor's proposal to appropriate $1.9 billion to PERS were to go into effect, that's part A of the governor's proposal. Part B is a capped $157 million payment from 2015 through 2036. That capped payment is very important, and the reason why we've proposed it that way is so that we can secure certainty with respect to the demands of the PERS system on the undesignated general funds of the state. And so if that were to go into effect, one idea with respect to this legislation is that any new unfunded liabilities associated with PERS employers taking up to 20% of their payroll out of PERS service, that would be tacked on to the end in 2036. Is there a cost to that? Yes. But what's important is any new unfunded liabilities are shared by the state and the municipalities. And that hasn't been the case since 2008 when we enacted SB 125. Any new unfunded liabilities are borne entirely by the state. And that's had some fairly dramatic impacts on the state's general fund. So we've seen the state assistance to PERS employers increase substantially to the point where when you count PERS and TERS employers, that we're looking at a call on the general fund of upwards of $1 billion in the next year.
So just so I understand this, the compromise, as it were, is that the relief that would be afforded to local governments now, the quid pro quo would be a sharing of new unfunded liability later. Is that in one sentence sort of what this is?
In one sentence, I think that's fair. I think the flip side of that is if there is the reverse of unfunded liabilities created, that is an actuarial gain, which we love to see actuarial gains. We've had those recently when the investment markets have returned more than 8%. Those are also shared. And under the governor's proposal, they would be shared in the form of a shorter amortization term. So under the governor's proposal, we would be municipal employers would pay at the 22% contribution rate through 2036. If there were actuarial gains at some point in that time period, that could act to reduce the amortization term so that the 22% could be paid off, or the 22% employer contribution rate cap could be adjusted prior to 2036. Now, that's entirely speculative. We have no way of knowing whether there'll be net actuarial gains between now and 2036 or net actuarial losses.
We're resigning that, and then we're going to take public testimony, or reopen public testimony. Thanks again, Mike.
Wait, it's for Mike.
Well, no, no. He's not going anyplace.
Mr. Barnhill, so good to see you. So under this scenario with the termination costs, what would happen to the municipality of Anchorage? They would be short funded by $5 million.
Okay, through the chair, when you say under this scenario, which
under the termination cost if this bill passes?
Okay, through the chair, if this bill passes,
or it doesn't pass, I'm sorry. Let's just go to if it doesn't pass and we continue down the path that we're on.
Okay, so through the chair, Representative Millett, if this bill does not pass and the status quo persists, what will happen to the municipality of Anchorage depends on whether they pull PERS employees out of PERS service. That is, do they terminate a group classification in the department? So in the event that Anchorage decides to terminate, what happens in smaller municipalities is sometimes they terminate a fire chief position. Seems unlikely in Anchorage's case, but let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that Anchorage decides to terminate a utility or privatize a utility, and it has a payroll of, I don't know, $5 million. If they pull that $5 million out of PERS service, then a termination study would be required. So first thing, they would pay the $2,500 or the $5,000 for the study itself. Then Buck, the actuary, would compute of those folks pulled out of PERS service, how many of them will vest earlier than anticipated, therefore creating a new unfunded liability. They'll compute that figure. Let's just assume, for the sake of argument, that it's $600,000. The Division of Retirement and Benefits would send a bill to the municipality of Anchorage saying, okay, you need to pay this new unfunded liability. And then for those employees pulled out of PERS service, the entire past service cost associated with that group of employees would need to be paid by the municipality through the final payoff of the unfunded liability, currently anticipated to be in 2031.
So could they pay that through an increase? We hold them harmless at 22%. Could they pay it over the lifespan until 2036 and pay 24%?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, the current statute has a provision in it that allows the municipality to work out a plan with the Division of Retirement Benefits. So there are options that we could explore with the municipality of Anchorage. Could they do it through an increased contribution rate? I've got Ms. Kathy Lee sitting behind me, and I'm going to need to have her come up and answer that specific question, if the chair doesn't mind.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Please read yourself onto the record.
My name is Kathy Lee, and I'm the Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And in answer to that question, yes, the statute's fairly broad in the type of arrangement that we can make for payment. So an increased contribution over time is a possibility.
Follow up?
Or a payment plan.
Or a payment plan, yes.
So it has flexibility enough that it's not due upon receipt, because I guess is what I'm asking you.
Yes, the statute requires it to be either paid upon receipt or for the entity to work out a payment plan with the division.
And that payment plan would be estimated to go out to 2036?
It could, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, thanks again. And I think we're going to bring Kathy Wasserman up for public comments. I think it'll be brief, but since she represents a good portion of the municipalities in the state, I thought I'd take advantage of having her in the room and welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Kathy Wasserman, Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League and 163 of those communities. Well, not quite. There are a few that are not PERS employers, so I stand corrected on that. Just a few little points that I'd like to make is that certainly, depending on what happens with this particular bill, municipalities need help. We need tools to manage our employees. If lean times are coming, and you can all nod at that one, we need to be able to lay people off if that's what it takes. And God forbid that the public realizes we're not laying people off if we've decreased services because we've got them in the back room knitting because it might be cheaper to keep them than to get rid of them. We just need your help in finding, in having tools to deal with any consequences that might come our way. I have to say part of us having this discussion with Representative Thompson was that we have been supporting the governor's cash infusion, thinking and having discussions with the fact that perhaps all of these termination costs could be tacked on to the end of that 30-year, 25-year amortization. And the amount of termination study costs would be so small compared to a $12 billion liability that we could pay that off maybe by extending payments a couple of months. I don't know. So this has been a plan for us to go along with the governor's $3 billion infusion. So we're not trying to get out of anything. We just, I guess like the state, realize we can only pay so much. We have also been supporting the infusion, hoping that we could keep our rates to a steady, predictable, budgetable, I know that's another word, 22%, so budgetable.
I think it's worded, actually.
Okay, well. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have a question.
Real brief.
Thanks.
We're running a bit over, and we're keeping public testimony open.
Keep the staff, too. So, Kathy, when I talk to my municipality, one of their big fears is if the termination costs, if this bill doesn't pass, at some point in time, there's going to be a increase that we'll have to increase our property taxes to the cap, and that still won't cover our portion of the unfunded liability payments to PERS. And so if I'm the biggest municipality in the state, I can only imagine that smaller municipalities will take on a greater cost percentage based on their property taxes and their population base.
Representative Miller, through the chair, that's exactly right. And then you have to realize some of these communities, very small communities without a tax base,
right,
because they may be on native allotment land, have no way to make that up. And so it leaves everyone in a bit of a bind. And like I said, we're not trying to get out of it, but we've got to find a solution that we can all afford and live with.
And thanks again, and we are going to hold public testimony open, and I apologize about not having the information out to both the public and the committee before 10 minutes before the meeting. But with that, we will hold the bill over, and we'll adjourn at 10 minutes after 5.